Welcome to the Full Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 12:19, and that is Pacific Standard Time. Well, this has been really quite an impressive week in markets, not least because you've had just some really quite extreme moves. And at least part of the reason for that is because for the first time in a decade, you're getting this divergence in monetary policy between between the USA and just about everywhere else. And that's contributing to volatility in the currency markets. And that was a huge move in the euro yesterday, where a short-term oversold condition received this incredible upward dynamic. And despite the fact that the euro was a little bit softer in here today, then not nearly to the same extent that it was stronger yesterday. And the size of that move suggests that bets that the euro is going to fall below 105 in the short term are unlikely to bear fruit, but rather that we're in for a reversionary move. Now, that needn't necessarily happen all in one straight line, but that more likely than not that the euro is going to unwind its oversold condition. In the precious metal markets, we've seen that platinum, silver, gold, and palladium have been falling for consecutive weeks, just one day after another, unrequiting declines one after the other. Well, it was a positive day on gold yesterday, but today's move broke the progression of lower rally highs that's been evident since the last time it tested its moving average, which was back in early October. So then the potential now for a reversionary move, at least back up towards the moving average, has increased really quite substantially for all four of the precious metals. A commonality right across the sector there. And then look at what happened yesterday on Wall Street, where the S&P was down 2% and then bounced straight back and was up 2% in here today. And really, that's an incredibly impressive move. It's been strengthening throughout the day. The Nasdaq, having been working on a downside weekly key reversal yesterday, completely countermanded its downward dynamic in here today and is up over 2%. So really, that's incredibly impressive. But the news flow is such that the ECB wants to keep its powder dry. In no way, shape, or form did Mario Draghi yesterday say that they weren't going to extend their monetary largesse beyond March of 2017. And let's not forget, that's still 16 months from now, and in between now and then, they're going to add almost €1 trillion in monetary accommodation. In addition to that, they're going to reinvest maturing issues. So there is no prospect of monetary tightening in the eurozone, and in fact, the potential is rather that they are going to institute additional monetary policy accommodation. But the size of that monetary accommodation is really what the market is worried about, not least because there is a sense of diminishing returns from the quantities that have been pumped into the sovereign debt markets primarily. So Bund futures today were a little bit weaker again. That's despite the fact that the US 30-year was up 1 2/3 full points. Bunds were a little bit weaker, so were gilts. But then you look at where Bund yields are coming from, and they've been compressing for much of the last 4 months. So then the potential here is that because of that sense of diminishing return on the amount of money that's being put in, then what the market demands is progressively larger amounts of additional liquidity to continue to depress yields. And since that was not the case, then we are in for at least a short-term move where we're going to see yields advance. And that's particularly the case on the periphery, where Greek yields have compressed about as much as they're going to. And the potential now is that we're going to see them widen out again. And I think that's probably the case too for Portugal. When you look at the US government bond yield, then at the very short end of the curve, even 2 years, you've seen a really quite a substantial breakout from a three-year base. And now the chances are that that is going to come back and retest the upper side of that base. But it's really unlikely that yields are going to push back down into it, considering that the likelihood is that the Fed is going to be raising interest rates. Wage growth has broken out. And more than any other factor, it's not so much whether food prices or energy prices are inflationary or deflationary, but rather how many people are at work, how much money are they earning, and are they getting more of it? And those are the really big questions from the Fed's perspective. Well, labor force participation has been depressed. Part of the reason for that is the baby boomers retiring, but it's also because lower to middle income families are just de-incentivized from going out there and looking for work if it means that they're going to lose their health care benefits or the subsidy that they receive on the government exchange for health care. And that's a not insignificant factor. So wages have to rise in order to entice those people back into the workforce, and that's what's happening. We have evidence of that. And, you know, it's the beginning of the credit crisis was in 2008, and we're in 2015 now, and generally speaking, it takes about 7 years to recover from one of those events, and that's around where we are right now. Well, then the question remains, how much of it is in the price? And there has been, despite the volatility yesterday and this smackdown to bears in here today, then there isn't any reason to doubt that the bulls are still in charge here. It was for the bulls to prove yesterday, and they came back in force in here today. Well, the US dollar was also flirting with 100 relative to the euro. And you can't think of a currency in isolation. You have to look at it in the currency that you want to convert it into. So against the euro, and the dollar index is mostly euro, well, then it pulled back sharply yesterday, and the chances are that we're in for a process of mean reversion over the short term. But over the medium term, the fact that the Fed will be raising interest rates and virtually nobody else will means that there's a positive interest rate differential stacking up in favor of the dollar. And that's something that we haven't seen in nearly 10 years. So it's not something that we can simply just say that this is going to be a short-term factor. In fact, this is probably going to be a long or medium to long-term factor. And then what we're presented with is US dollar preeminence and the relative strength of the US economy relative to just about everywhere else. Well, it's worth bearing in mind that the US economy is almost 70% consumer. So the earnings of some of the exporters will be affected by the relative strength of the dollar. And their US business won't be affected at all. It represents a partial headwind for some of the autonomies. And if you can look at, for example, Apple, and what they're doing is that they're issuing foreign currency debt. So they're paying for that debt with their foreign earnings. And that helps to insulate their balance sheet from the relative strength of the US dollar if it has to be repatriated. And then I suspect that that's what we're going to see from a number of other of the large companies, that they're going to use financial engineering and they're going to be smart about their corporate treasury in looking at the creative ways to hedge their exposure to the dollar, because generally speaking, they haven't had very good results from trying to do that in the currency markets, or indeed the swap markets. When we look more generally, and I suppose this is the big picture long-term audio for the various different asset classes, then it's been our contention that we're in a secular bull market, but that the end of quantitative easing isn't likely to happen without a little bit of a shudder along the way. Well, we certainly had a big pullback in October, and markets have roared back. That doesn't mean that when something is 20 or 30 or 40% overextended relative to the trend mean that it's not susceptible to a pullback and a consolidation. Well, at the chart seminar last week, somebody asked me about the FANG trade, which I thought was a very interesting acronym. But I guess FANG was Facebook, Apple, Netflix, and Google. And I guess you could throw Microsoft in there as well. There, well, Apple is not overextended relative to the trend mean. Really far from it. But when you look at some of those other companies, and they're all autonomies, and they all dominate their respective industries, well, then you would have to conclude that this is not particularly the best time to be buying in here right now. But rather, that when they eventually do pull back to their respective trend means, then that's been a favorable buying opportunity before, and it's likely to be a favorable buying opportunity in future. When we look at the equity markets generally, then, well, I guess another thing that we did at the chart seminar last week was we looked at lots of different sectors, and we were looking for base formations because, well, one of the delegates had been at the chart seminar in 2011, and you know, that's, you know, when we saw that biotech was just about breaking out of a long-term base. So we were looking for additional evidence there. But if you look at markets after they've been rallying for 6 years already, then you're less likely to find base formations. And the sector that is really depressed in here right now is resources. Energy in particular is showing a positive divergence between the price of oil and the price of the energy, the major energy companies. And it really is worth making that distinction, because smaller companies that are highly leveraged are experiencing a great deal of difficulty in a low price environment, whereas majors have got, generally speaking, a lower average cost of production. And that is standing them in good stead in the present environment, and not least because they've cancelled capital expenditure. So the majors, in terms of oil producers, are doing reasonably well in this environment, whereas you look at some of the smaller companies, not least Southwest Energy, and they're accelerating lower at this stage. We continue to see that there are really bearish forecasts about the oil price as it flirts with the $40 level on WTI. And there is the potential that oil prices go lower from here. But perhaps a broader question is, how low will they stay and for how long? Because the price environment that we're presented with right now is being driven by OPEC pumping at really record levels, and the fact that North American production hasn't really started to deteriorate just yet. But deteriorate it will. Now, you can't simply stop drilling and cut back on capital expenditure and not expect there to be a supply response. And when that eventually happens, then prices will start to turn around. Well, $40 was the upper side of the base. $40, well, in fact, I think it was $32 is where prices bottomed in 2008. And then we had a sharp reversal. Now, of course, a great deal of additional unconventional supply starts to become economic around $60 to $70. And prices right now are around 40, so there isn't any incentive to continue drilling at today's levels if there's the prospect that when prices eventually do bounce, that they could almost double from where they are today. But of course, when they do double, then drilling will accelerate and supply will increase. This is a very similar type of scenario to what we saw in natural gas, but about 4 years ago. And there is no shortage of natural gas, and every time prices get up towards $4, supply increases considerably and prices come back down. And we've been in a volatile ranging environment in natural gas for the last 5 years, and there is a high possibility that that is the kind of scenario that we're going to see in oil prices as well. And a lot of that is already in the price. But that to think about the energy sector in those terms would mean that you're assuming that the world is going to stay static, and it most certainly will not. That we're in a very liquid environment, not least in terms of geopolitics, but also in terms of technology. And technological innovation is rapidly accelerating. And your graphene was first synthesized about 10 years ago. And the big question has been about how to mass produce it. And there are innovations happening on that front all the time. And eventually, it's going to get to a stage where the discovery has been made, the commercial investment has been made, and then the global economy starts pumping out graphene at a prodigious rate. And when that happens, and it might yet be another few years, well, that's going to change a whole host of sectors. It's certainly going to change the energy sector, because once we start installing cheap graphene in solar cells, then it's going to result in, you know, a really considerable benefit in terms of their efficiency. When we start using graphene in batteries, and when we start using graphene in our computers, well, the efficiency is going to increase, the ability to store energy will improve, the call on additional supply will decrease, which will allow demand to explode. That will be massively beneficial for the global economy. It means that fossil fuels will have a competitor. And more than any other factor, over the medium to long term, that's going to keep a lid on prices. Well, then prices are low now, and oil prices have the potential to rally from not far off these levels. And consider that the price to go from 40 to 20 would be a 50% decline, but to go from 20 to 60 would be a 200% decline, and or advance, excuse me. And that is the kind of volatility that we can expect in the oil markets, and it certainly won't be for the faint of heart. And generally speaking, the majors are likely to be the ones that benefit most in the short term, and then we're going to see some major rationalization in the smaller companies, and relative strength in that sector will be rewarded. Well, to the extent that some of the smaller energy companies are under pressure, some of the smaller miners are under extraordinary pressure, and that's no different for some of the majors. We don't have that divergence in the mining sector that we do in the energy sector, and I think a lot of those companies are still struggling to find a bottom. However, while copper prices are still weak, tin, lead, nickel are not trending lower in nearly the same way that we've seen with oil prices. So in that regard, we're seeing this divergence between the commodity price and the performance of the equities. Generally speaking, what that means is that there is just too much supply around, and a number of these companies have got themselves into trouble financially. So there is ample potential there for rationalization as well. And again, it would be relative strength would be where real evidence that the factors that are affecting the sector are not particularly in evidence. And if something is leading at this stage, it's leading for a reason. And generally, that would be something that would be quite interesting at this stage of the cycle. And in the gold sector, well, gold shares have been outperforming the gold price because gold prices have been relatively steady. And obviously, we've had a big decline over the last 6 weeks. But generally speaking, while gold prices made an incremental new low, they haven't really moved much in the last couple of years. And we've had a huge rationalization in gold price, in gold mining shares. So that now, generally speaking, the NYSE ARCA Gold Bugs Index has been ranging for the last 3 or 4 months, and we're starting to see evidence that some of the better performers, and particularly those that have got a yield, are breaking out. Well, gold's relative strength will be in here today, and the bounce that we've had for the sector generally will also be of benefit to the gold miners. And that'll be particularly the case for miners that are listed and have operations in countries with weak currencies. And the Australian dollar has certainly not been strong. The RBA has been really quite clear that they don't want a strong currency. And, you know, considering the headwind that Australia is encountering from the slowdown in economic activity from the infrastructure sector in China, then it's pretty hard to make a medium-term bullish case for the Australian dollar. Rather, we're going to see ranging with a mild downward bias, I think, for the perhaps the lengthy medium term. Well, if we have U.S. economic preeminence, then Europe still has a lot of trouble. And they entered this sovereign debt crisis a bit later, and it's going to take them a bit longer to get out of it. What we saw this week was that the equity market in Europe is very dependent on quantitative easing. And in that regard, it's really quite similar to how the US market was behaving in about 2011. That we had really quite a lot of volatility around the decisions about whether to remove or add quantitative easing in 2010 and 2011. And compared to where the S&P is now, then the Euro stocks is only about halfway up or back up towards its 2007 and 2000 highs. And as long as the ECB is still printing, then there's every reason to expect that that index is going to trend higher, albeit in a volatile manner. Then if we look across at Asia, then the yen is currently trading around 123. And if the ECB is printing, so is the Bank of Japan, and they're starting to express fear that it's not working fast enough, and the Japanese economy is in recession at present. So they have an extraordinary incentive to try and get inflation moving and to try and get economic growth going. And so far, their solution has been monetary. Well, what they're going to need is regulatory. And they still have a lot of work to do. But as long as they're printing money and printing it in prodigious quantities, then the potential for the Japanese market to continue to advance has to remain the base case. So the Nikkei was down about 2% in here today. But with this storming rally that we're seeing on the NASDAQ, then the potential is that we're going to see a number of those Asian markets stronger tomorrow or on Monday. And if you start to look at China is still going through just a massive transition. They spent 25 years in an infrastructure and infrastructure property and export-oriented growth model, and they're trying to transition to a consumer-oriented society. So the types of companies that are really leveraged to that development, such as healthcare, technology, and consumer discretionary, they've continued to outperform. Unfortunately, they don't represent very large weightings in the primary indices on the mainland. So it's the finance sector, it's the particularly the banks and the infrastructure development companies that represent the largest weighting. And well, the banks are pretty well capitalized, but they have a lot of loans outstanding to state-owned organizations, and there is this problem that they have with excess capacity in a number of industries. And you had Li Keqiang, the premier, in here today talking about that they're going to address this problem with vigor. Well, we'll see. This continues to remain a really quite a huge challenge. And against that environment, they simply can't have tight monetary policy. Because to go through that type of reorientation means that they're going to need loose monetary policy to take up some of the slack. That should generally be positive for the stock market. And they'll want a stock market that's at least steady in order for people to have some confidence that what they're doing is bearing fruit. So they've defended the 3,000 level on the Shanghai A-Share Index, and chances are that they'll continue to defend that level. And it means that we're going to be in for, and in fairness, the market has held a progression of higher reaction lows since last testing that level earlier, well, back in the summer. Well, at some point it's going to break that progression, and we could be in for a more volatile ride. But in the meantime, as long as the progression of higher reaction lows remains in place, we'd be giving the benefit of the doubt to the upside. And generally speaking, despite the fact that, you know, that corruption and authoritarianism are very much hallmarks of how business is done in China, we can say that governance is improving from a low base. And generally speaking, it isn't the level of governance that's necessarily important, but rather that there is a trend of improving governance. Well, we have that in China. We have it in India. And if Dilma Rousseff is finally impeached in Brazil, well, then there's the potential that we'll have improving governance there as well. And, you know, they had a landmark election in Argentina last week, and it's a new administration, so the Kirchners are out. And again, this is a potential that we're going to have improving governance in a major economy. Then the question is European governance improving? And that remains very much a question. And the migrant crisis that is currently assailing Europe is going to be a challenge. And the migrant crisis all on its own is just a perfect exemplar of the failure of Middle Eastern governments to implement any kind of improving governance. That autocracy and despotism are generally not the kinds of political environment, regulatory environment, or that will promote individual shareholder rights, the independence of the judiciary, and property rights. Well, those are the three things that you need. It's not necessarily necessary that you need governance, democracy. Well, it's democracy. You get those three things, generally speaking, with it. But those are the key ingredients for improving governance. And when you have them, then you can get really quite an impressive reaction from the capital markets and international investors. But unfortunately, in the Middle East, we just don't have that. And in fact, what we have is deteriorating governance and wars on a number of fronts. And a terrorist organization that is able to encourage people from thousands of years away. And that is also a byproduct of technology. And unfortunately, that means that we're going to have to have some grown-up thinking about it. And I can't remember which politician described it as joined-up thinking. And there was what is increasingly likely to have been a terrorist attack just 35 miles from here yesterday. And then there has to be something very wrong in the world which will encourage somebody to start building pipe bombs and developing an arsenal of weapons and walking into their Christmas party to spray their colleagues with bullets. Well, then there are obviously psychological difficulties there, but there is an environment where people feel desperate and they feel that they have little choice or that there isn't another way. Well, it's a very difficult environment, and to counter propaganda is one of the most difficult things that there is, and we can only do so by positive example. And not least positive example from the people that are within their own community. And unfortunately, that's not something that we see to a great extent within the countries from where these terrorists are coming from. And that's a problem. And that's something that's going to have to be addressed if the root causes of terrorism rather than the symptoms are going to be addressed. Well, to the extent that this has anything to do with markets, then is the Middle East going to be somewhere that's going to be a favorable investment environment for the foreseeable future? Probably unlikely in the absence of a real change in the standards of governance. Then is there the potential that terrorist attacks are going to escalate? And I think that that has to be the base case in the absence of really concerted effort, that terrorism has gone global, terrorism has gone mobile, much in the same way that we would talk about the flow of international capital, and they seem to have absolutely no difficulty in funding themselves either. So then that has to raise the question that the response has to be mobile, the response has to be global, and the response has to be swift. So and in the absence of that, then the impact on consumer sentiment, the impact on the lives of ordinary people is going to be profound. And that represents a medium-term consideration. Then when we look at the bullish factors, then technology is improving all the time, and technology has obviously enabled some pretty nefarious characters to do what they do, but it also enables massive good and massive productivity development. And in fact, its technology is likely to be the solution, that raising productivity growth and economic development in an environment where standards of governance are improving are the kinds of things that drive secular bull markets and mass employment. And generally speaking, then those are the kinds of things that rob terrorists of their rallying cry, because they generally do best when people are miserable and are downtrodden. That's no less the case today in the Middle East as it was in some of the poorer areas of Northern Ireland, or in you can say the same for a number of other terrorist organizations, that they do best in recruiting when the people that they're recruiting feel aggrieved. Well, energy prices are unlikely to rise, like I said earlier. Well, that's very positive for the global economy, and really not great news for commodity exporters. And particularly energy exporters. And technological innovation is going to be wonderful for the rest of the world. And it is now posing a really considerable threat to the Middle East, because they've been able to live off the dividends of exporting oil for the last 60 years. And that's going to remain the case for a considerable amount of time. But it's not going to remain the case forever. And like they said themselves, the oil or the Stone Age didn't end because they ran out of stones. And the fossil fuel era won't end because they run out of oil, but rather that we'll need less of it. That means that this is an enormous challenge, and it means that eventually there will be a resolution and that governance will improve. But what has to happen first in order to drive that remains very much open to question. And this conflagration that is gripping the region is unlikely to end anytime soon. Well, when we look then at the global market, then there is plenty of reason to be optimistic about it. Technological innovation is improving and is accelerating. That we have energy prices that are unlikely to get back to where they were just a few years ago. And in inflation-adjusted terms, that they could quite easily trend lower over the lengthy medium term. That with wages moving up, then the potential is that we're going to have inflationary pressures rising. And that's not something that's in baked into the generally into commodity prices at all, or indeed into stock markets. But government bond yields are starting to rise. And rise in a gradual manner, but they won't always be rising in a gradual manner. It means then that stocks are going to be where one gets the best inflation protection, and particularly in companies that are able to raise their dividend above the rate of inflation. And that's a medium-term consideration. And because we have improving governance in some of the world's population centers, and among those are China, India, Brazil, and even Nigeria, then the potential is that the upwards of 2 billion additional consumers entering the global economy are going to do so in an environment where there is improving governance. And despite the fact that we are going to have high-profile conflagrations and terrorist attacks in not only in the Middle East, but elsewhere, that's not a reason to dismiss the fact that governance is improving elsewhere, and that it's happening in perhaps the most important places where we have the most people living. And that's a very important factor. And I think with that, I'll leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.